in now for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Well, welcome into our streaming show today on your News for Utah Plus app, wherever you're watching this. We are so glad you're here. I'm joined today by Rusty Cannon and Adam Gardner. Fellas, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to be with you. Okay, introduce yourself real fast. Tell us who you are.
Rusty Cannon with the Utah Credit Union Association.
Okay. I'm Adam Gardner. I'm a lobbyist here in Salt Lake.
And neither of you speak for your organizations, although you work for yourself.
I work for myself. I speak for myself, but not my company.
Right, for not your company. And obviously, you don't speak on behalf of the credit union.
Correct.
You are just Rusty Cannon. Not
yep.
just. I don't say that in a way.
It's just.
Producer Peter's here, too. Hi, Peter.
Hi, everybody.
I love your T-shirt today.
Oh, well, thank you. It's nice and clean.
Clean
that's,
is his
That's standard. The bar I set for today.
That is a really good standard. Okay, I want to hit what we're going to hit off the top. Just so you know, you can stick around with us for the next half hour or so. Utah House Majority elected some new leadership, so we're going to talk about that. We've got a vacancy in the Utah Supreme Court, which is a big deal. That's significant. Nationally, we've got the big, beautiful bill waiting for its fate in the Senate, and then we've got Elon Musk and President Trump, who are kind of at odds over this thing. We're going to talk about how this bill moves forward, whether it moves forward, and kind of some of the provisions that are holding things up. So let us start with what's happening right here in our backyard, and that is Utah's House Majority just elected new leadership. So for people who don't maybe follow politics, they're like, cool, what? Like, who cares? But these are the folks that kind of guide the majority in Utah's House, right? And that's significant just because, obviously, we're a Republican-dominated state, and so these are the folks, the top of the chain as far as the Utah House Republicans go. So, Rusty, let me start with you. Casey Snyder's our new majority whip. He's a representative from the Paradise
Majority Center. Leader.
Excuse me, Majority yep. Leader. Thank you. Our majority whip would be
Candace
Perucci. And then Bridger Bolander of the Tooele area is assistant whip. So what do you make of this new leadership?
You know, it's an exciting new team. What was interesting about this time, and I haven't seen it in the time I've been involved, I don't know about Adam as well, that this was sort of a wholesale change because you had Jeff Moss resign and yep. then two members of leadership wanted to jump up into his spot. So you had three vacant offices. And so this was could have been a seismic shift. What I think happened is, well, first of all, with the election, when I looked at all of the folks that were running, they were all phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I think I don't envy the House members and having to pick from them. It's kind of like pick, you know, your favorite of the favorites. They're all phenomenal. Casey Snyder has been there for a good amount of time and is very effective, you know, as a legislator. Same with Candace Perucci and Bridger Bolander. I'd like to say now afterwards, this is what I predicted would happen, that all the winners that I was betting on, so to speak, mm-hmm. won. But I thought those were some of the ones that had the best chance in those. And it seemed like a fairly clean process, and they're up and running. You're exactly right. They drive the ship.
Yeah.
The leadership, it is a leadership-driven system, whether it's in the minority or the majority, and they're sort of the voice of that majority. So it matters, but for those like us that are, you know, more involved in the weeds, we pay a little bit more attention to it.
Yeah, because these are the people, Adam, that you got to go lobby to get your bills passed on behalf of your clients. So
And luckily, we've had experience working with all of these folks before. They've been great to work with. I've known Casey Snyder for 15 years. We both worked for Congressman Rob Bishop together. Great relationships there. Candace Perucci has been a friend and her husband for a really long time. They've been known in political circles before they were in the legislature. And Bridger Bolander is from Tooele, kind of brand new to the scene. He's a sophomore legislator, which is pretty cool yeah. that they put their trust in a sophomore in just his second term he's going to be in. Casey Snyder was at the time when he was elected the youngest member in the legislature. Candace Perucci was 27 when she was elected. She's a 32-year-old woman who's now going to be in House leadership, which is a new, very cool thing. So there's a lot of firsts. It's also really telling. It's not just who kind of guides the House, but it's also who the House members are saying, this is who we want to lead us, and this is kind of the direction we want to go.
And speak to that a little bit. I'm curious how policy shifts under this leadership team. Is there a way in which you see it shift a little bit, or
depending
is it still
on
what the speaker says?
Sure.
And
you have some that are further right, like Rex Shipp. If he would have been elected, that would have the House would be saying we want to go in a very like in a far more further right direction. So you can look at who was elected, and there are a lot of really common sense people. They're not going to push too hard. They're not going to do anything particularly crazy, but they're also not going to back down. And it's interesting because it's not just we're voting for good Republicans. It's we're voting for good Republicans who will go fight the real enemy, which is not the Democrats. It's the Senate. And the Senate kind of thinks the same thing. Like,
ooh, those are fighting words.
We need people who will go against the House and get our priorities. Because even though they're all Republicans, they're all the majority, they have two very different directions they want to head sometimes. And so that's where the fight is between the House and the Senate.
And I want to talk about that tension for a second. This is what I witnessed during this last legislative session. The House and the Senate not talking to each other. And that's evidenced by the amount of conference committees that I saw. Conference committee for the layperson is when, you know, the House starts a bill, it goes to the Senate makes changes, it's got to go back to the House doesn't agree, they got to get in a room, literally,
yes,
and hash it out. And so there were so many conference committees. And to me, just as a political reporter, that signals to me that those bills aren't being worked out before they get to the floor and somebody made a change and we don't like it and we got to get in there and make sure it's settled. Does this new leadership team fix that, or is that a speaker and president type of situation? How do you see that, Rusty?
Well, I think it could change the dynamic a little bit, but I don't think that's anything new. I think there's been many years where I've seen very little tension between the Senate and the House, and somewhere it's been pretty intense like this last year. I don't think a lot of it spilled out publicly, but that back and forth is good. I think you had some other dynamics this session for whatever reason that were, I think, fairly time specific. So I don't know if I'd see a big sea change in that. You want that healthy back and forth, but I think in the long run, I think President Adams and Speaker Schultz are pretty much aligned on most all things. And coming into the session, their priorities are fairly well aligned. So I don't see a lot
of
drama.
Don't you think it's
coming,
like the last week, 10 days?
I think that's part of it too.
I don't feel like I saw that under Brad Wilson when he was Speaker of the House. I mean, I've been covering the legislature since 2020. So it's been 5 years. This was my fifth session. And I've seen the sea change between Brad Wilson and Mike Schultz. And I don't feel like I saw that. Maybe that's just my own experience.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe that could be. I don't think, if that's the direction that it's heading, I don't think that's going to get any better. I think the speaker and the president have to manage their own caucus. They have to manage their own members. And so even if president and speaker totally agree, it's not necessarily going to play out that way. If the members of the body are saying, no, this is what we want, go fight the House for us, then that's what they're going to continue to do.
Interesting.
And I don't think conference committees are a bad thing.
Like, no, it's good.
Let's go hash it out. And if we can't reach an agreement in a conference committee between the principals who's negotiating the bills, maybe the bill is just not ready for prime time, and that's okay too.
That's an interesting point. All right, let's move to another local issue that's really significant here in Utah, and that is a vacancy that's coming up on the Utah Supreme Court. Associate Chief Justice John Pierce is stepping down. He announced that this week. He won't step down until the end of December. His term is up at the end of December. He says he's going back to teach and practice privately his own law firm. I mean, just high level, what do you make of a Supreme Court vacancy at this point in politics?
Well, it'll be interesting to see if the Senate has a greater focus on the process this time because of what happened this last year. None of us paid attention. Well, I'm just speaking for myself. I never paid attention to the confirmations of judicial appointments before that. It's a rubber stamp. It's over. Now, I wonder if they have a bit more of I think it's maybe a little unfair to whoever is going to get nominated for this position of like, oh, okay, now we're really going to ask you a lot of tough questions.
Well, they are coming in at a tense time.
Yeah, exactly. And to see that. I don't know if that's how it'll play out. I think it'd be nice if that did play out a little bit. So there's a little bit more sunlight into the process because, as we found out, if you don't pay attention to it, you might end up sort of putting the seeds in place for a Supreme Court that makes decisions that you're not happy with. So
Justice Pierce has also been kind of around the block for a long time. He served as general counsel to Governor Gary Herbert. So he's been involved in the process, been a public official kind of for 16 years. So he's been around. So now I guess he just wants to go make money and be able to say whatever he really thinks, which is a good thing. It will be interesting to see how this process plays out, but I asked a judge who's a good friend up in northern Utah, are you going to apply? It's much different than how the federal system works.
Yeah, maybe just explain how it works.
And I'm not the guy to explain, but from what I understand, when I was talking to him, I said, are you going to apply for this? And he said, no, it's a gauntlet. Like, I hated doing it just for my judgeship. And you have to go in front of panels that that get together and they evaluate your decisions and your resume and your history and what's been overturned on your side. And they go through everyone that applies. And then that nominating commission sends 7 or 8 names to the governor. So the governor can only choose from those people, 1 that have applied and 2 that have made it through the vetting process.
But I think that's an important process because we often talk about the appointees, which administration appointed them, right? Governor Cox has appointed 2 of our Supreme Court justices. Yeah. And we've seen the justices in the last year really push back on decisions made by the legislature. So there's sort of this like kind of overarching thing that maybe, you know, the Supreme Court is quote unquote woke, right? But this is a very strict process.
They're all qualified.
Yeah, and
they're all qualified.
You can't get through that gauntlet without being qualified.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you see Governor Cox shaping the court, though, with this open seat?
But that kind of gets at the heart of the question. Like, how much can he shape the court?
If no one applies and no
Yeah,
one,
he's yeah. only allowed to choose from these 7 people. On the federal level, Trump can say, I want Kavanaugh, I want Amy Coney Barrett. Like, that shapes the Supreme Court. That's a big deal. The governor doesn't have that power here, so he can choose his favorite out of those 7 or 8. But I see whoever gets nominated and confirmed that will be a typical Utah Supreme Court justice that respects the law, that isn't in it for themselves, and that will just do what they think is right. Now, we may disagree with them, and the legislature may disagree with them, but I don't think any of them are corrupt or doing it for any other reasons other than they believe that what they're doing is right and legal.
Can you talk about sort of the significance of how many significant rulings we have waiting in the pipeline from our Utah Supreme Court? We're talking redistricting. We're talking abortion cases. We are talking what else am I missing? I mean,
there's a lot teed up. And yeah. I don't think there's been as much scrutiny on Utah Supreme Court decisions, at least in my experience, in my lifetime, so to speak, than now because of what's unfolded.
Oh, Utah fits all. That's the other one.
Yeah, yep, exactly. All kinds of very critical issues to both sides of the aisle you're right, that will be decided soon. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I don't think the governor can put his thumb on it at this point with different nominations. It's just the Supreme Court of Utah is so different than the Supreme Court of the United States.
And they don't make that many decisions.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like there's only a few that come out a year. I obviously don't follow the courts like I should, but mm-hmm. mostly because when I read them, I don't understand them, and I have lawyer friends tell me what they mean. But I feel like they have this huge workload. There's a lot of different petitioners to the Supreme Court, and we're just not seeing a ton of decisions come out of that body mm-hmm. over the course of a year when they're in session. So I don't know how much will change, obviously, some of these big, big decisions. But I feel like in Utah, some of these appellate court judges have a lot of the power because it's all – the buck's kind of stopping there, not really to the Supreme Court.
Is there any context here in terms of, like, how common is it for a Supreme Court justice just to serve 1 term? Or do they typically apply for that second 10-year term? Because they serve 10-year terms, which is a long term. I mean, Justice Pierce's term is up right at the end of this year. Is it common for him to be done at this point?
You know, that's a good question. I've never looked into how long they stay.
It's pretty common. There's some that have made it their goal to be on the Supreme Court for the rest of their legal career, and they'll stay for multiple 10-year terms. But there's a lot that once they hit that 10-year mark, they're out. And it doesn't pay. It doesn't pay like a great lawyer, the type of money you picture of a great lawyer making. And so a lot of them will say, I'm doing this 10 years is kind of my public service, and then I'm going to go make money or teach or do something else. So we've seen that with Justice Durant, Justice Jimonas, and others that know when it's time to get out. On the Supreme Court level in the United States, you're seeing a lot of these guys stay until they're 80 and 90 years old. Does not happen in the state of Utah. Very uncommon.
I was joking with some people that now Justice Pierce is a lame duck justice, so he doesn't. He's not beholden to anyone. He can just rule however he feels like it.
Which is great.
Mic drop. Peace out. Rusty's like shivering.
Please no.
There's please no such no. thing as a lame duck justice. All right, let's move to some of these national issues here. Feels like the only thing going on in Washington right now is the Big Beautiful Bill. This is Trump's signature budget package where he's trying to codify his 2017 tax cuts. The bill, though, adds to the debt, right? That's a big concern for Republicans. It's waiting for any sort of movement in the Senate. Let's just talk high level. How do you see the Senate getting a hold of this and what do they do with it that doesn't exist right now?
Rusty's very pro debt, so I want to hear what his position is.
I love debt. No, the issue with the Senate is, do they tweak it enough to where it goes back to the House and fails?
Yeah.
And they don't have a lot of wiggle room. But based on what we're hearing as of today, they do have issues with the SALT issue, that they think it was too generous and want
state
to pull that back.
Taxes.
State and local tax. Yep. Thank you. To where those New York and California Republican reps will be in the hot seat in their mind if they mess with that. So that's one issue. There's others that just feel like there really weren't legitimate spending cuts in it, and they want to make it a little bit more aggressive. So Senator Lee's in that camp and a few other senators as well. But there's really not a whole lot they can do without tanking that whole effort. So that's really interesting. In addition, Senator Curtis is in the crosshairs, I should say, mm-hmm. On his wish that they be a little bit more careful with the repeal of the clean energy tax credits type of stuff. I think he has a point. However, that is some very dangerous landmines you're about to step on as far as the conservative movement and, you know, wanting to get rid of all those just wholesale. He's going to have to be very careful and articulate about making his points and not getting run over. I think the other question is, do they get to a point where they stand up to President Trump and say, no, I'm not going to stand for this. We got to change it or move the bill forward. Or does President Trump come in at the end and say, listen, I know you don't like it, but you're going to vote for it and just take it or leave it. I have no idea how that plays out.
I see President Trump saying and doing that, saying anyone that is against the bill, he is publicly going after. But really the only Republican in the Senate that I've seen go after the bill and say, like, this is atrocious, no way, is Rand Paul.
Yeah.
He's the only one that's really been saying absolutely no way. And he says to my fellow Republican colleagues, you're all talking about waste, fraud, abuse, spending, but all of you guys voted for the last bill that continued the Biden spending levels. Nobody voted for the DOGE cuts. Mm-hmm. They don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that's a real problem in the Senate. They're not codifying any of these DOGE cuts. They're not allowed. The president is not allowing them to touch Medicaid, which was a big piece of the House bill. And as a Republican lawmaker, that's kind of crazy to say that these are sacrosanct programs, because Republicans are always going after entitlements. So to say that you have to leave them alone is kind of crazy. But the only one saying, absolutely not, we are not going to add $2.4 trillion to the deficit over 10 years, which is crazy. That's even more than what they're spending now. That's mm-hmm. what we're adding. Mm-hmm. We are spending $1 trillion a year in interest payments. That is more than the entire military budget, entire DOD. That's crazy. That's unsustainable. And there are some Republicans who are saying, we still stand by that. We are using our Republican talking points to say we're not okay with adding to the debt. And so, especially now that Elon Musk has come out against the bill, Mr. Doge himself mm-hmm. Has called it a disaster. He also went after the EV credits that were going to be taken out of it.
He said,
fine, you can take those out. I don't care. It's still a bad bill. He's like,
is that part of the clean energy stuff that Curtis is
thinking? Curtis is more of sort of business side of things and investment.
Picture his old district, his old congressional district. It's a lot of geothermal. Yeah. It's a lot of carbon capture. It's a lot of these unproven technologies that are working in the state that the state's investing heavily in. So he wants those credits to stay in there. So I get it. Mm-hmm. And I think he's right. But it's interesting just that now that Elon's come out, how many people are really going to change? And I've seen Mike Lee engage quite a bit on Twitter saying we need to tweak this, but he's not going against the bill at all.
Yeah, I think Elon is flat wrong. Just the point behind the bill, if we rewind the main point of the bill is to make sure there's not a $4 trillion tax hike on Americans. Because if they don't do anything, all the 2017 cuts expire.
With the debt.
Well, okay, but here's the truth about the debt.
I mean,
this is not the bill that is going to fix the debt. They can talk about it all they want.
But you shouldn't make it worse, should you?
But that's based on assumptions from the CBO that are fairly conservative and are not dynamic. Then you hear some people in the Senate talking about that. So what the CBO does is they go, well, we're going to take an educated guess as to what we think happens. And then that's taken as gospel. That's not necessarily true. When they made the projections on the 2017 bill, they were wildly wrong. They wildly undershot the revenues that it would bring in. because they lowered taxes, it brought in more revenue. They're doing it again. So when people say it's adding to the deficit, that is based on an assumption. We have no idea how much it's going
to
add.
But to your point, Lindsay, and to yours, we use these CBO assumptions.
The Congressional Budget Office.
Congressional Budget Office.
Yep.
They took in more money. After 2017 tax cuts, the government took in more money than they ever had before. We still spent more money than we ever had before. You have to do both.
Yeah.
You have to cut, and you have to cut taxes. You can do both.
Yeah.
And right now we're not seeing. There's also two other really stupid provisions in the bill that are getting a lot of heat. One was the AI provision that said that no state is allowed to make any laws regarding or restricting AI for 10 years. 10 years is insane.
And that would significantly impact Utah.
Impact Utah. I think it's wrong. And I think that Congress is wrong for putting that in the bill. And I think that David Sachs, the advisor to President Trump, is wrong and horrible for doing that. And then there's the other provision in there that says that the president cannot be held in contempt when a judge says – a judge can't find a president in contempt for disregarding their rulings.
Right.
That's targeted at President Trump, giving him permission to ignore Supreme Court rulings and other courts. I think that's wrong. But will that pass muster with the Senate? It all depends on what the parliamentarian says. Counts as budget. You have to pass the Byrd rule whenever you go through a reconciliation. So if the parliamentarian says, no, this is not budget related, it goes out. Yeah. Hopefully that will be the case on these two provisions.
Well, and I'm wondering how, I mean, this is like a political tool. I see this at the local level often where one thing is good, one thing is really controversial. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We put them together and you got to vote for the whole package. I mean, to your point, can you support the lower taxes if it, one, raises the debt and has these really concerning provisions in it?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the two pieces, does it cut, maintain low taxes, and does it reduce spending? Does it reduce spending? No. Will you vote for it so that you can keep the taxes lower, cut, as we say, or maintain those tax cuts?
Yeah.
I think most elected officials will say yes and work on solving the spending problem better. That's where I think it's a little disingenuous for Elon Musk or others to come out and say how bad this bill is. It doesn't reduce spending. You have a 53-47 Senate and what, like a two-seat majority in the House? You're not going to change spending. If you want to change spending, you got to rework your majority in Congress, make it big enough to where you can do something serious. In the reality we're in now, we are not going to do that. And it's not going to happen with this bill. So why are we complaining about it? Let's prevent the tax cuts. I'm sorry, the tax hikes from coming and keep those in place, pass the bill and try to, I think if anything comes out of this exercise, which is hopefully good, get the garbage out of it. Amen. But that's the debate unfolding.
75% of the entire budget, 75% is not voted on by Congress.
Yeah.
It's all entitlements.
Correct.
If you do not address that, which President Trump has said, do not touch it, which I think is insane, you are not going to fix spending. That is telling me that President Trump does not care about the debt and deficit.
Never has.
Never has.
He never has. Never.
So interesting. I want to end by just sort of touching on this relationship between Elon Musk and Donald Trump. I mean, we're seeing it deteriorate before our eyes, right?
Surprise. It's weird you can't have two narcissists be best friends for more than 6 months.
That's right.
It's weird how they clash. But what do you make of that? I mean, what do you make of sort of, you know, I think Elon came out today even and basically said, I helped get President Trump elected. I mean, kind of admitting that that was the case. I mean, he's a big donor. You're shaking your head, Rusty.
Yeah,
so please.
I think
he spent nine figures on getting Republicans elected. Yeah. That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. It's rounding error for him. And I think his ego is coming into play, and I think it's unfortunate. To be a good statesman, you've got to sometimes take your ego and put it in the drawer.
Which is what we've seen from President Trump. He has just humbled himself to get what he wants.
Yes, you're making my point in the best way. That just these are two massive egos
crazy.
Now colliding. But I think that's where Elon, it's just, there's a time to step away, and I think this is it for Elon, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, go away.
Yeah.
We agree.
Go back to doing your rockets.
Let's end on a kumbaya moment. Our panelists agree on the going away of Elon Musk. Producer Peter, what did we miss? Did we miss anything? Did you want to fact check us on anything? Is there anything?
No. You all policed yourselves quite well. There's a couple points I was going to jump in. I think it was well pointed out that, you know, the White House position on the big, beautiful bill is we don't agree that it's going to add to the debt as much as CBO believes. I would maybe add in on the side that similar projections have come out of institutions like the Cato Institute, for example, which I don't think is, you know, hostile to the White House most of the time. So I mean, we will have to see. And I do tend to think that the version of the bill we have right now is not long for this world. And I think you already have seen several key Republicans in the House. My home state of Georgia's Marjorie Taylor Greene has already said she would not vote for it if it went back to the House. So I think this thing is far from done. Trump wants it done by July 4th. I'm not bullish on that projection.
Yeah,
that's the main thing I was going to hit. Other thing on the Elon point, I would go even further and say Elon not only said he helped Trump win, but he claimed had he not spent that money, that it would be a 51-49 Senate and that Democrats would control the House. And I do think that is a little self-embellishment here, right? I obviously you can't argue that Elon wasn't centrally involved to the campaign, but to imagine that extent of impact, I don't think that this election was going to completely wash out the Republicans' advantage on inflation and such things without Musk's help.
Yeah.
Well said. I think Amen. Elon thinks he is a lot cooler but than he really is.
Absolutely.
This is how Tesla was founded. Tesla had two founders, and he came in very, very early and took over and made it very successful. But he says he's the only founder of Tesla, that it was only him.
That's false.
Huh? And that's false. So he does this, and we all recognize it. We all know that it's not true.
I don't think anyone's surprised that this is where the relationship is ending up.
We shall watch how it continues. Adam Gardner and Rusty Cannon, thank you so much for your insights today. We appreciate it. Producer Peter, always good to hear you chime in. Thank you for watching on our streaming service today. Share this episode with your friends. Tell your friends that this is the coolest new show in Utah politics. So pass it around. And we'll be back next week.